Kitty Hart Moxon, Reel 2. Yes, it's very interesting what you're saying about the ghetto, you know, comparing it with what we know about the Warsaw ghetto.
Yes.
You were saying earlier, I think, that there was no sort of organisation.
Is that not while I was there. There was no organisation, and I'm going as far as 1941, or perhaps, I don't know the exact dates, but I would say it was about 41. No, it was total disorganisation, because all these people were being brought in. And I don't know whether they brought in all these people to the Warsaw ghetto, as they did to the Lublin ghetto. But, of course, what transpired later, that the whole area had been designated a resettlement area for the whole of Europe. But we didn't know.
But was there ever any resistance, you know, for instance, when the troops stormed in with these awful raids?
Well, I'm afraid there couldn't have been any resistance. That was absolutely impossible. I mean, anybody as much as raised a hand, everybody would have been slaughtered. I mean, that was very, very obvious that at that stage you couldn't have resistance, and you couldn't organise any resistance because of the total clampdown. If you had contact with other ghettos, then you could have had resistance. If you could have had help from the non-Jewish population, you could have had a resistance. But that took a long time to organise. And by 1941, there was no such organisation. That came much later. But by that time, I was no longer in the ghetto. The other thing that happened in the ghetto was, of course, the Jewish councils. They had been giving orders to the population. They had been getting orders from the German authorities, which they had to carry out. And they had this Jewish police. I think one of the things I remember from the Lublin ghetto were the ransom demands that this Jewish council used to receive from the German authorities. Today we want 100 fur coats by such and such a time. You know, this was the sort of demand. Tomorrow we must have 1,000 wedding rings. You know, these were sort of demands that came along, you see. And so you had this Jewish council going from house to house, getting people to give up what they had so that they could pay off the Germans. Well, again, my father realised, you know, that can't go on, that something is going to happen. And at that stage, he decided we must make a break. So what he did is we were disguised as peasants one night, just with bundles on our backs, not suitcases, anything like that, because it would have been suspicious. Just as peasants would walk around with baskets and, you know, long coats, and just like the Polish peasants, in fact. And we took off our armbands, we threw away our documents, and we walked out of the ghetto. And that was only just before, a very, very short time before they actually sealed it. Because my father had no idea where he was going. He decided south was the only way you could run. You couldn't go east or west or north, you see. West was Germany, east was Russia. The country was closed by then. There were fighting there. So he thought he was going to head south. At night you couldn't walk because there was a curfew, but he did try and walk part of the night. During the day, through fields, because you couldn't go anywhere near main roads, and he was purely guided by the sun. He didn't have a map, he didn't know where he was going. Anyway, we walked on and on and on for some days with my grandmother, and we stumbled on a small village. And that, in that village, was a very small Jewish community. And we decided that the only place we could stay was a Jewish community, because of the documentation, registering and all this business, and we couldn't register anywhere else. So we actually put down in that village, and I don't know how far it was from Lublin. I imagine it could have been about 50 miles or something like that. So we walked some days, and at times we couldn't walk, we had to lie in ditches because, it was too dangerous to walk. But we weren't stopped. We were very lucky. We didn't encounter a single patrol.
How did your grandmother stand up?
She was very, very hardy. Yeah, very tough old lady. She did. She stood up to it very well, walked all the way there. When we got to this village, we were not welcome with open arms. You might know there were already some people from nearby towns. Apparently, that there was an influx of people running away. And it was a Jewish peasant population. We've never encountered Jewish peasants. They were working in the fields, and nearby were very large estates, and a lot of the people were employed on these estates. Well, my mother decided she was going to make contact and see if she couldn't sort of do something else and perhaps teach English. And sure enough, she was welcomed with open arms on one of the estates. And the estates, funnily enough, were full of refugees who were running, and those were Poles, running away from the Russians, because there was a Polish aristocracy that was being persecuted by the Russians, you know, from the territories that the Russians took over. And they were fleeing onto the German side. And they were hiding, you know, the people they knew there, sort of full of these aristocrats on these surrounding estates. And they had nothing to do. And when my mother arrived there wanting to teach English, you know, they were absolutely delighted. In return for food, we didn't want anything else. And even my father was accepted, and he worked there in the library. And in the end, I was accepted, and I was sort of teaching the little children, just reading and writing. So in a way, we could have stayed there and survived the war if we had been allowed to be left in peace. But of course, we knew that time was running out, and patrols kept coming past. They didn't even know this Jewish community existed, because all the Jews that were there were peasants, you know. But sooner or later they made the whole population register there, just the same as everywhere else. And they had to confess they were Jews, you see, because the Poles knew they were Jews, they were going to betray them anyway. So they knew where people went. We had to register. If you didn't register, you were taken away. So we had to register. Well, we were there, I would say, possibly about 8 months. That's quite a long time. What we didn't realise, what nobody knew, again, there was no contact with other communities, that, in fact, surrounding this small area there, well, within perhaps 100-mile radius, were no fewer than about 4 extermination camps. There was Sobibor, Treblinka, not all that far away. There was a place called Travniki where they trained the SS. There was Belzec and Majdanek. And we had not the vaguest idea. There were all these extermination centres. And all these people that were being rounded up from all over Europe were in fact disposed on our doorstep. But we didn't know. We were in this small village. It didn't leak out, you see, because of this incredible secrecy. No one ever knew at that stage. Nobody knew what went on. Surrounding this area were lots and lots of dense forests, and a lot of people had actually got into the forest, and this is where the partisans, that's where the resistant partisans eventually managed to form into armies and you know, sabotage and fight the Germans. Now we're going to 1914. I think it must have been 42 by then, 1942.
So by then the Germans would have invaded Russia?
Yes, by that time they had already invaded yes. And the frontier was very near, and of course there were the aristocrats, the refugees were still coming over onto the German side. But of course a lot of the Ukrainians were pro-German anyway, so that they were running away, you see, from the Russians and coming onto the German side and volunteering to join the SS units. And many of the action groups that we know today as the Einsatzgruppen were in fact composed of Ukrainians and Lithuanians, and they carried out the massacre because they knew who the Jews were, whereas the Germans didn't. Of course, they were not particularly recognizable as such, but they spoke a slightly different language. They didn't come from that area. They could be picked up quite easily by the population, you know, by the indigenous population. Anyway, in 1942, we received more and more ransom demands in this village. Again, the authorities came, the Germans, there wasn't a Jewish council as such, but they came direct to the village and demanded, with certain ransom demands. Again, the demands were different. 3 dozen eggs today, 100 chickens tomorrow. This was the kind of ransom demands. First they wanted only gold and jewelry, but because at that time people just didn't have anything else to give. And no way could they produce all the ransom that was demanded, the blackmailing that went on. And there was also a threat. They threatened, well, if you don't produce so-and-so by such and such a time, we're going to deport the whole, all of you are going to be deported. Well, we didn't know where at that stage. We didn't know about the extermination camps just down the road. But we didn't expect anything. We didn't know what to expect. But, you know, my father decided again, you know, we must try and get out. It doesn't matter where, but we're going to go. It came a day when certainly they couldn't produce the goods. I can't remember what they actually asked for. I don't know if it's at that time, but whatever they asked for, there was nothing to give them. And that there came a deportation order, actually. And so actually we had a forewarning that something was going to happen almost the day before. Very often you didn't know, there was a total surprise. Suddenly a place was surrounded and everybody was taken away. But we already had an inkling something was going to happen. And a lot of the young people got into the forest. And my father decided we must get out at dawn. We must get out early morning. We saw people going into the forest. We said, must do the same. Well, my grandmother was not going to go any further. She refused to go at that stage. No, she said, you must go, I stay here. And she wouldn't go. And so we got into the forest very early one morning. And this village lay in a valley, sort of quite low down. And it must have been about August or something, because I remember the cornfields were all surrounded by this high corn. And the forest was sort of quite high up. And there was a clearing in this forest, and so we were hiding in the forest, but we could see what was going on in this village. And we saw the actual rounding up from the distance. The whole lot was surrounded by armoured cars or such, or lorries and things. And you know, they all came out with the lorries and the helmets and the rifles, surrounded the whole place. Got people out of the houses and loaded them up onto carts, and there was a lot of shooting going on. They could hear all the shooting, and took them away. Of course, what we later found out, they took them down the road to bury it. That's where the whole village was wiped out. Anyway, we got into the forest, and these forests are not, they were not just like we understand forests. They were almost like a jungle. Eastern Poland has got a special name for a forest. It's called a puszcza, which is it's so dense that if you go in, you're going to get lost, and it's total darkness. And even the Germans wouldn't go into the forest, into these forests. And they certainly couldn't bring an armoured car or anything like that into the forest. And they didn't like venturing into the forest, although they would come in with dogs now and again. But they knew a lot of people had got into the forest. Now, we walked through this forest, and we knew that the estate had a hunting lodge there somewhere, and we actually located this. And I don't think my father must have researched it before, because he found this hunting lodge. And we got there, and there was a forester there, and he already knew that we were coming. I think my mother must have had a word prior to this, and that, you know, if anything happens, we're going to try and get into the forest, and could he do something for us? And so this forester took us in, and he put us in the loft. And there's just a ladder into this loft, and he put us in there, covered us up with straw, and took the ladder away. You know, there was no access to the top at all. And we were there for some days in this haunting loft. And then a patrol came round. We heard a lot of dogs, and they did actually search for people and search the lodge. And a dog came and sniffed all around. They didn't find us. However, after that, the forester decided it was too dangerous for us to stay there. And in fact, he wouldn't keep us there because, you know, if they had been caught hiding people, they were liable to be shot on the spot. There was absolute no mercy for people there to try to hide Jews at that time. So he made us get out into the forest, you see. And we lived in this forest, I would say, we got deeper and deeper into the forest, and we were there some days, some weeks. And we sort of lived on berries, and at night you could hear the wolves all around. But we were not actually afraid of them, but you could hear them, and you could see the glowing eyes of the wolves. Because these forests still had a lot of wild animals. At that stage, you know, we were not particularly afraid of the wolves, but we were afraid of the actual patrol coming in to the forest. But as we got deeper and deeper, we realised they're not going to venture into the forest, but we knew we couldn't stay there, you know. So eventually, my mother and I made a break to this to the estate. That forest was part of the estate, I think. And of course, they were not very pleased to see us. But I got sick at that stage, unfortunately. I'd never been ill, and there I was sick, and my father actually had to carry me at one stage. My father decided my mother should try and go to the estate, just at least to allow me to recover. And we went. We got to the estate. It was it belonged to a baron. What was he called? Turnau. He actually had a German name, Turnau. And he wasn't very pleased with it. But my mother explained that I was sick and had been in the forest for some weeks. And he locked my mother and I into a room and to seal us off because he had all these other poles there, and he was afraid somebody was going to find out we were there. And they actually got a doctor in to look at me, and it transpired I had hepatitis. I had some sort of form of jaundice. I was all yellow, you know. And so they put me on a diet there, and I was sealed in this room for I don't know how long. And when I recovered, I can't remember how long it was, he said, we were going to get out. We were going to go. So it was arranged by my mother. He must have taken us back to somewhere around this hunting lodge, and my father was somewhere around that area, still in the forest. And then he dumped us there, back in the forest. Then my father decided he was going to attempt to go and see if he can't make his way back to Lublin, or to the Aryan side of Lublin, to the priest who said, look, if you're in mortal danger, try and come and ask, see if there's anything I can do for you. So my father, you know, decided, well, that was the time to actually go, although he was putting everybody in danger. But he decided, no, there was no other way at that stage. We couldn't go on living in the forest forever. We were living on berries at the time, and so it must have been a time of the year when, you know, there was plenty of sort of food to live on in the forest. So he made his way, and he did. He had no documents at that stage, you know. And he made his way to Lublin. I don't know how he got there, but he got to Lublin. This priest said, yes, he's going to try and get some documents for us. The vital thing was to get birth certificates. If you could get an Aryan birth certificate, you could, on the strength of that certificate, obtain a proper identity card. With your identity card, you could obtain a Russian card, you could register, and you could stay somewhere and perhaps be undetected if you were lucky. So he tried, and my father, he had to pay for this to my father. He still had some, I believe he still had some jewelry. And by the way, I must just go back to the ghetto, if I may.
I must just tell you that during our time in the London ghetto, we lived in a one room, and one of the chaps that lived with us, in another family in fact lived with us, was a dentist. And because he wasn't allowed to practice dentistry, but he sort of looked after our aunties, and every time there was a patrol passing by, which we used to keep a lookout, all these dental instruments went under the bed. And so my father decided he still had some diamonds, and he decided that somehow or other he's got to get his diamonds. I don't know whether they were rings or I think it was also a bracelet. Get his diamonds out and get this dentist to fill my teeth with diamonds. I couldn't see the point at that time, but my father foresaw that there might be an occasion where there might become, I might need these diamonds to perhaps to pay for my life or for my food. And so this dentist drilled some of my back teeth and filled them with diamonds. And that is how I actually come to lose most of my back teeth in the end, because they had to come out. And of course, I needed these diamonds, quite rightly. Eventually, the priest decided, we must come to this vicarage. And so my father managed to send word, I don't know where, how he sent word, but I think it came via this forester and this hunting lodge, and because we were not all that far away. And the message was, would my mother and I try and make our way back to Lublin, to the vicarage? But we were in the most terrible, bedraggled condition at that stage. So we were cleaned up by these people and actually gave us clothes. And my mother and I, without any documents, and they gave us a little bit of money, we actually boarded a train, which was totally forbidden, even for Poles at that stage. You know, they were not allowed to travel. But my mother and I took the risk, and we boarded a train to Lublin. We got off and made our way to the vicarage. When we got there, my father was hiding in the coal house. Just as I explained before, it was opposite the Gestapo headquarters, and of course he couldn't be seen to be there. So this priest hid him in the coal house. It transpired that the priest obtained birth certificates for us. Now I was to have a new name and a new date of birth, and I was to have been born in Lublin, and I had a different family, and I had to be taught all these things. And also the priest decided if I was going to have this new birth certificate, I would have to be baptized first. So he took us into his chapel and he decided to baptize all of us before handing over these documents. Anyway, the plan was, that once I'd learned my new CV, which I had to, I was no longer the daughter of my mother, and my father had a different name, and this was rehearsed over and over for some days, and that was all in the coal house, and we couldn't get out of there. It was decided that we would have to part in order to survive. No way could all three of us have been stayed together. My father was sent to a small town. The priest found him a place to stay with some peasant, and also found him a job. I think it was a sawmill, some such work, with his new documents. And my father decided that my mother and I couldn't possibly stay in Poland. We would sooner or later be found out, we would be betrayed. But he thought if we could go and find a transport of Poles that
that were being rounded up, because the Poles were also being rounded up, but they were being rounded up and taken as slave labour to work in German factories. What happened there? They would surround a church or a cinema and take all the people into a collecting centre, and then they would sort them out. They would take the young males and females, and the children they would send back home. And in this collecting centre, they would stay for several hours. And that sort of roundup would take place at random. Nobody knew when, but word would soon go out of when there was a roundup. And the idea was that both my mother and I would stay in that coal house until we heard about that there was a roundup in the city, and we would actually make our way and get in to this collecting centre. And that was actually at the railway station at that point. And so the priest actually took us to as far as there, and we had new documents, and we parted from my father in this coal house. And I'm afraid it's the very last time that I've ever seen my father, because after that, I'm afraid we didn't have any real contact with him again.
What was your name now?
Well, my new name was very complicated, Leocadia Dobrzyńska, very Polish name. And my mother's name was Sulewska. She had a totally different name. She was to be just my aunt, or not really related to me very much. And my father was totally unrelated. I can't even remember his name. And so he stayed there for some time until things were ready for him. My father stayed there for some time until it was safe for him to proceed to this small town. My mother and I did manage to get into this transit area where we found an enormous commotion, where people were fighting to get out, and we fought our way in. Sooner or later, they pushed us into a train, just ordinary passenger train, and before we know where we were on our way to Germany in a transport of Polish males and females being taken to work as forced labourers in a factory. And this train just went on and on and on, and my mother and I just sat there very quietly trying to recuperate from the last couple of months in the forest and everything that had happened. And we felt relatively safe having had these new documents, but of course we didn't dare make conversation, not even with each other, because we did realise that for a start our accents were different. We came from a different part of Poland, and immediately we might arouse suspicion. And we were taken to a sort of a transit centre where people were being distributed to different factories. And 50 of us, 50 girls, and my mother, of course, being elderly by that time, were taken to a factory of IG Farben, called the Aluminium Werke, that was the aluminium works. I don't quite know what they were doing. They were certainly producing some aluminium works, because the girls were working, shaking out sacks of aluminium dust, which was absolutely horrible sort of work. But the first thing that happened when we got to this factory was we were taken to a small hut, which was allocated to these 50 girls, and interviewed individually. And we were asked, could anyone speak German? They had to write your CV, and of course I had to write my new CV, my new name. But I did confess that I could speak German, and so did my mother. And so my mother, having been older, was told she wouldn't have to do any work, she'd just look after this group and make sure that the girls are at work and are presentable. And I, being the only person that could speak German, was taken away from there. Well, I was taken to work in an office with the only person out of this group
to work in this office. By the time I was about 14 or something, 14 and a half. At that time, already, there were very short of office people because most of the German workers were already taken into the army. Although not the females, of course, because there were very few people actually working in just a particular department. And I was taught how to issue different meal vouchers for the whole of this big concern. And that was quite a complicated procedure because they had all kind of different workers there. They had the Poles, who were forced labourers, and they had Yugoslavs and Italians, who were voluntary workers, and then they had Germans. So there were all these different categories of people, and they all had different meal vouchers. They were not all allowed to eat in the same canteens, and all different colours, and there was a hierarchy. But because I was put in charge of these meal vouchers, and because I was working in an office, I was privileged to eat in the German canteen. So in order to eat in this German canteen,